Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 196. What are the advantages of determining the type of an object by how it behaves? What coding circumstances are not a good fit for duck typing? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week, bringing another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. Christopher covers a recent Real Python tutorial by Leodana Esposo Ramos titled Duck Typing in Python. Writing flexible and decoupled code. The tutorial explains the concepts of duck typing within object-oriented programming and its use within Python's built-in tools. We discuss a recent article on monkey patching in Python. This practice of dynamically modifying a class or module's behavior at runtime allows for testing, debugging, and experimentation. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a news roundup. My name's are not the same as objects in Python, using IPython Jupyter magic commands, a discussion about becoming a senior developer, a data exploration challenge, a Python evaluation game, and a terminal UI for regex testing. This episode is sponsored by Sentry. Fix application issues before they become downtime with Sentry error and performance monitoring for Python. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right. Well, I wanted to mention that we got some feedback from a recent episode, and I know we were kind of reaching out and saying, please let us know what you think of the show, leave ratings and reviews on your podcast choice of platform. And we also have a voicemail link where you can leave us story ideas or topic ideas or guest ideas. And that's available at realpython.com/podcast. And we got some recent listener feedback, and I'll play the recording. It's from Todd.
Man, this is really cool, this voicemail thing you have here. I really appreciate your podcast. Been listening for quite a while, but this last episode, Practical Python Decorator Uses and Avoiding Date Time Pitfalls from Beginning to End, is hands down the best, for me, episode maybe of any podcast I've heard. And I've been a fan of podcasts since we were putting them on CDs. So well done. And just absolutely perfect timing in my project. So thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
So it's kind of fun. I think it's cool that people can leave the feedback on the tool and we can put this recording in. If you're interested in leaving feedback that way, you're welcome to. We also take it in email form at podcast@realpython.com, or you can find us on the socials that we mentioned before.
Yeah, thanks, Todd, for your kind words, and we're both very curious as to what you are, what kind of date function you're decorating, how that worked out perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah, some kind of decoration of dates of some sorts, you know. It wasn't, you know, just after the holidays, right?
So we could have been, yes, there you go. Insert your own Christmas pun here, yes.
Yeah. Well, this week we have our usual set of topics and discussions and projects, but we also have a few pieces of news to get started. So you want to get going with that?
Yeah, sure. First bit is the DjangoCon US call for papers is out. This year's DjangoCon in the States is in Durham, North Carolina, and it's from September 22nd to September 27th. The accepted presenters get free entry to the conference and up to $500 travel cost reimbursement.
Nice.
They're looking for 25-minute, 45-minute sessions, as well as three-hour tutorials. And there's a couple other things like lightning talks, and I think they've got a small number of slots for virtual and a few other things. If you're interested, details will be linked in the show notes.
All right.
The second bit of news is actually news, as in something that went out across news wires. The White House has issued a report from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency Department of Redundancy Department, making recommendations about programming languages. Large software producers such as Google and Microsoft are currently estimating that 70% of all software vulnerabilities are due to memory safety issues, which can, of course, be avoided by using a memory-safe programming language. The report then proceeds to list recommended languages, and as you're hearing it here, you've probably already guessed that Python made the list. The link that we'll provide is the PSF's response to it, and it's kind of interesting because they're sort of humble about it. They're like, we're happy to be on the list, and by the way, we talked to C, so there's some places where we're not memory safe, so we're still improving kind of thing. So kind of an interesting read.
Yeah, kind of goes into our Rustification thing there a little bit too. Huh?
They mentioned it explicitly, trying to replace some things with Rust in order to try and solve these kinds of problems. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And then the final bit of news is release news. JupyterLab 4.1 and Notebook 7.1 have been released. The JupyterLab release includes over 100 bug fixes and is their largest minor release for them ever. So if you're a JupyterLab person, go grab the latest copy.
Yeah, be digging into a little bit of Jupyter stuff a little later for one of my topics. Awesome. So that takes us into our main topics this week. My first one is from, well, let's just call him friend of the show, Stephen Crepetta. He's also a Real Python contributor, and he's actually got a kind of a neat tutorial coming up, so be on lookout for that. This is from his site, which is called the Python Coding Stack, which you've mentioned before. I feel like this article is geared toward beginners or intermediate devs, and I think I say this pretty often, useful for people coming from another language, as it covers several Python quirks that are, well, especially unique in, well, how it handles objects and pointers and things like that, and reference counting, and kind of ways to explain those concepts, plus a couple wrinkles, which I think is kind of a fun way that he digs into this. There's several themes. Names are not objects. Reference counting is one of the themes. He gets a little bit into scope and namespaces. He talks a little bit about removing those things, removing labels, deleting names, and then garbage collection there. And then a couple of the references go into deeper dives and how things can be a little bit odd with certain objects that have to do with the differences in mutability and immutability, i.e. interning and immortal objects, which is very recent. And he gives you more references as to where to dig into that stuff. So I like how Stephen writes. I think he changes his style depending on who he thinks the intended audience is for this particular piece. So this one's really friendly, very approachable. It's kind of like he's coaching you as you go along personally. He provides code snippets as you go and a collection of all of them at the bottom of the piece, which I think is neat. And I really like the use of graphics that he has to kind of throw metaphors in to kind of give you an idea what's happening with objects and naming things. He starts out with a bit of a curveball to start right away in his first example, which has a little bit to do with Python 3.12 and how it handles immutable objects and their reference counts. And we've talked about it, a little bit of a spoiler here, immortal objects. And so this is a chance maybe to kind of see that stuff in action if you just heard us just talk about it a little bit. His example in that case uses strings. He switches into Python 3.11 and shows how that it's been up to now, up to recent days in 3.12. He dives into an example right after that using lists, so into more of a mutable object. He uses tools from sys, a method called sys.getRefCount, no underscores there. And what that will do is if you put an object's name into that, it will show you what the reference count is at this thing at that time when, say, you print it out. And so he goes through a script showing the number change as he's assigned things. So he starts with assigning a list to a name. So he gives it my underscore numbers equals square brackets 7/19/51. And then he shows how assigning that a new object to that name of that existing object in my numbers. So he says, like, okay, cool numbers equals now my numbers. So now there's two references to the same object there. And so the reference count shows that, continues to get into other relationships where, well, what if those two were embedded in another list? So kind of two references in one list to two separate lists. What does that do to the ref count and so forth? He shows about deleting objects and what that does to your ref count, continues to show a little bit about if that goes to zero, what happens in the garbage collection that's happening there. He gets a little bit into namespaces and an area of confusion for a lot of early developers, this idea that if you name something outside of a function versus if you name something inside of a function, and how those two names are not connected or related inside those two namespaces. So it's possible to use the exact same name of something inside there and have a different reference. But that's not true in a for loop versus, well, it is true in a list comprehension. And so there's kind of some interesting things there. He digs into sort of edge cases that you might run into. A little bit about immutable objects and how they handle references differently. Again, I mentioned this idea of interned values. I think we brought it up in the show before, how there's a set of integers that are referencing always the same object. There's basically going to be one reference to them in a similar way to something like none, only has a single reference. And then he talks a little bit about the mystery from the beginning and how immortal objects are working with 312, just briefly describing it to kind of give you an idea how that's unique and how that might show a very different number when you use the git ref count. So really good stuff. I don't know if I even mentioned the name of it, which is kind of funny because it's what's in a name. And so again, naming objects, talking about references and digging into all that stuff. So again, great stuff for beginners or intermediates who maybe are a little scratching their head, or again, how does a language like Python deal with this stuff? If you are interested in digging deeper into this type of topic, we have an article titled Pointers in Python, What's the Point? I think this is a good leaping off point for you there if you want to kind of understand a little bit about how, well, what is happening with memory? I guess this is really our White House news story a little bit too, in the sense that things are done slightly differently inside of Python and has its own method for managing these things. So thanks, Stephen. So what's your first one here?
Well, it's been a while since I've covered a Leodonis Pozoromos article, so I guess we're overdue.
Yeah.
This one is called Duck Typing in Python, Writing Flexible and Decoupled Code. If you've not come across the idea before, duck typing is the programming concept that interfaces are based on whether an object responds to some set of calls. The name comes from the old saying, if it walks like a duck, it talks like a duck, it must be a Maserati. I think I messed that up. Anyhow, quack. If Python's your first language, this might seem a little obvious, but in most compiled languages, you have to be explicit about a class's interface before passing it around. A lot of Python's flexibility is born out of the fact that it is duck typing by design, but that also has drawbacks. It's sort of associated with the dynamic nature of the language. Technically, you can create a duck typing language without it being a dynamic language, but the two concepts tend to coincide in the sphere of programming. Anyhow, so Leodonis starts out with an example consisting of three classes, a duck, a swan, and an albatross. And each class has swim and fly methods. All three have the same swim and fly methods, so you can do general bird things with the classes, not caring which underlying class is actually being referenced. In this case, the swan and the albatross classes are quacking, just like the Maseratis. I'll stop with that. With the basics out of the way, the next part of the article talks about the pros and cons of duck typing. On the pro side, you get greater flexibility, simplicity, you don't have to do explicit type interfaces, and easier reuse. On the con side, certain kinds of errors have to wait until runtime, and the lack of explicitness can mean for some tricky debugging and maintenance issues. All things in software are trade-offs. As with all Leodonis articles, this one is a deep dive. I've only covered the first quarter so far. He goes into places where duck typing gets used in the built-in libraries, how to support duck typing in your own classes, some code approaches that are alternatives to duck typing if you're trying to solve the same kinds of problems, and how duck typing interacts with the Python typing system. So if you're exploring object-oriented programming in Python, this article is definitely something you'd want to check out.
Yeah, nice. As a sister thing, if you haven't listened back to episode 88, I had Luciano Amayo on, and we discussed TypeInt's protocols and ducks in Python. Kind of dug into a little bit of duck typing there and some of the concepts and how it really helped him fall in love with the language a little more in some ways, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah. I can see it coming from Java and trying to do something similar in Java. It's always you built an interface and you had to include the interface everywhere. And coming to Python, it was sort of a, hey, you mean I can just use it? I don't have to go back and change what that class inherits from it. I just call it and it works. And
yep.
It compensated for the lack of brace brackets and how creepy that made me feel when I started coding Python.
Semicolon.
What do you mean? I want my semicolons and my brace brackets.
Give back to me. What is this white space?
20 years of being a C programmer does to your brain.
Fix application issues before they become downtime with Sentry Error and Performance Monitoring for Python. Whether you're taming Python's processing power or controlling JavaScript's flow through Node.js, backend infrastructures are as complex as they are valuable. With Sentry, you can trace issues from the front end to the back end, detecting slow and broken code to fix what's broken faster. Within minutes after installing Sentry, software teams are able to trace Python performance issues back to poor performing API calls, as well as surface all related code errors to fix what's broken faster. As one engineering leader said when starting to use Sentry, the time to resolve errors went from days to minutes. Installing is easy, and new users get 3 full months of the team plan free when you use the code RealPython on signup. You can find a link in the show notes or visit sentry.io. All right. Well, as I mentioned before, I was going to dig into a little bit about the Jupyter world and IPython. And I have an article on the Towards Data Science blog that's on Medium. It's titled Using IPython Jupyter Magic Commands. And it's a little bit of a misnomer. It's interesting because it does have a first quarter of it that is talking about generally, you know, what are magic commands and how they work. And it made me think of an article that I covered recently. It was from Vincent Matinde. It was titled Unlock IPython's Magical Toolbox for Your Coding Journey. And that one was really more about IPython. And I think I focused on that, IPython being our great alternative REPL, read, evaluate, print loop tool that's, you know, similar to stuff that I've used like BPython. And if you want to go beyond the standard built-in REPL that you get when you type just Python in a terminal, or Python 3. When I had talked about that article, I think I neglected to point out that, yes, IPython's this great REPL, and you can kind of do a lot of interesting stuff inside of it, but all of the magic stuff that I covered in that one is also available. It's the same engine in Jupyter Notebooks and Jupyter Lab, and actually other things like Databricks and a few other platforms that use IPython as their basis, and all the magic generally transmits there. And so in that piece, we talked about some of the magic commands, like things that you can do for navigating the file system. You might have seen this stuff appear in notebooks before and kind of wondered what the percent signs in front of all this stuff is doing. So the navigating the file system stuff, and I might have mentioned, was percent PWD to see what your working directory is, percent CD to change directory, or LS to list. There's a bookmarking thing where you can kind of save all those locations, tools for loading data in, looking at your code history. And there's a reference sheet that's in Vincent's article. I also learned a new command as I went through this, and it's a built-in command, another magic command that's just percent quick ref, no spaces or underscores. And that one actually brings up a nice quick reference to all these types of commands. So I found that by really digging into the IPython docs, which have a really good page on magic commands, alphabetically listing them and going through it. You might have seen in the wild, the one I would see the most common is like percent time it. But there are ones that, like, you can do percent debug, or if you don't want to use their debugger, you can use PDB. So you can do percent PDB. Another file one that was kind of cool that went beyond the stuff I was talking about before is percent DIRS, which will give you like your current directory sort of stack, which is neat. Percent edit opens an editor, which I think is, you know, maybe you like working inside Vim if you want to work with a file specifically, or Emacs or VS Code or what have you. You want to get outside of this sort of simpler environment that the REPL's there, and you want to go to an editor. And then one I wasn't expecting was percent GUI, which enables a GUI event loop integration. So that works with WX, Qt or QT, TK, and I guess even Cocoa if you're doing some old Mac stuff. And then there's some fun ones that go a little further, like percent macro, where you can define a macro for future sort of re-execution. It accepts ranges of history, file names, string objects. There's package management, things for calling out Conda and Mamba. And then one of the things that I don't think was covered in the other one, partly because you were working, again, in IPython in that REPL, if you're in a notebook, you have kind of an environment where you're not looking at just a single line. You're maybe more interested in what a cell is doing, and that might have a whole chunk of code you're running. And you can run these other specific cell-based magic, if you will, by using 2% signs. And so %% bash allows you to run a bash script if you want. %% HTML lets you have blocks of HTML on there. In fact, it is a web sort of format. So if you want, you can do %% JavaScript or even %% SVG if you want to display some kind of graphical content. LaTeX is in there. So I thought that was neat stuff. And this is a really long introduction of the part that I found initially most interesting, because I was like, oh, I didn't know that there was this whole other side of this thing. And again, I think the resource that was there was really nice and covered a lot of the stuff, but I wanted to build on top of it. But the article that Stephen Kroschick wrote, Using IPython Jupyter Magic Commands to Improve the Notebook Experience, is actually only a quarter of it is about that stuff. He really digs into this idea, the next level of it, of making your own custom magic command. And the article shares this history of this project that he'd been working on at Stitch Fix. And he includes links to, I think it's about 5 other articles on his background and a place where you can check out what this project is. Their project is called Hamilton. It's an open source tool to define testable, modular, self-documenting data flows. But this particular piece is showing you what if you wanted to get that functionality of Hamilton as a magic command that you could then, it's almost like a decorator in some of the ways that it's being used inside of your notebook. And so the concepts get pretty heady from there. It takes you through about 6 sort of major steps: setting up the code, defining what the magic command is, parsing input arguments, implementing the command's logic, and then how to register that command. He provides the links back to the IPython docs about this, about defining custom magic commands and making this IPython extension. If you work inside of Jupyter Notebooks and haven't played around with some of these wonderful built-in magic commands, this idea of building your own, I think, is like kind of this next step. Thanks, Stefan. All right, what's your next one?
My next one's from Karishma Shukla, and it's called Monkeying Around with Python, a Guide to Monkey Patching. I seem to have accidentally picked up a theme around dynamic coding this week. A monkey patch is a change to your code at runtime. Karishma uses the analogy of modifying your car's engine while you're driving it. This comes back to the dynamic nature of Python. Not only is everything in Python an object,
hey,
but everything in Python is a dynamic object. Have a function you like a lot? Why not attach it to an object as a class method on the fly? And yeah, you can do that. So now this isn't something you do every day, but it is a very powerful tool if you decide to dig it out of your toolbox. The article covers some real-world use cases with examples of when you might want to monkey patch. The first example she covers is fixing bugs in third-party libraries. Say you were importing a function called calculateArea that did the math wrong, and then in the module you want to import that call, you can write your own function and reassign the original function reference to point to your function instead, so compensating for somebody else's bug. The rest of the code would then call your function without you having to change the rest of the code. The second example in the article is about mocking for tests. In fact, this is really what the Python unit test mock library and its cousins actually do for you. My favorite example of mocking in tests is when dealing with codes that manage dates. So let's say your code is supposed to get the current date and time. Testing with that can be problematic as the current and date and time tends to change, you know, every time you run your tests. Time is funny that way. So one way of getting around that is to mock out the response to the now function and have it return a hard-coded value that you then can expect in your tests. So you don't have to explicitly monkey patch in this case because you can use the mock library to do it for you, but you're essentially using the same technology. I've only personally used monkey patching, not counting mocking, a couple of times, but when you need it, it can be a really, really useful tool. Krishma finishes off the article with a few warnings. Dynamically tampering with your code tends to make debugging more complicated. That's kind of, yeah, yep, I'm pointing the gun at my feet. I need to know that if I pull the trigger, I might lose a few toes.
Yeah.
It can also have unforeseen consequences when you think you're only affecting your code because you're changing the code and then somebody else might, some other chunk of your code might call it or somebody else's library might call it. And then finally, it also becomes a little more complicated as to how you manage this in your repo because it isn't a vanilla piece, right? You're hooking things in and then, you know, so where do you put it and how do you let other developers know that it's running, all that kind of good stuff. It sort of reminds me of one of my favorite warnings I ever saw in an industrial lab, which is don't look into laser with your remaining eye. Lasers are useful, but careful where you point them. If I were a more clever man, I'd make some oblique reference to Planet of the Apes here. Speaking of apes, we're going to talk about management next, right?
Nice. Yeah, well, it's kind of funny because I think that most developers don't think of it that way. And unfortunately, I think both of us are going to lead into that pretty quickly. So our discussion topic this week is from an article by Vadim Kravchenko, and it's titled Falsehoods Junior Developers Believe About Becoming Senior. And there's, I don't know, six different sort of themes. And I thought we could kind of dig into them as we go. I think Vadim is interesting. I want to call him a character, partly because he has a feature or a thing that you can interact with him if you're interested that he calls Roast My Resume, where you can submit your CV to him and he will quote unquote roast it for you. Hopefully it's a little more friendly than term I think of roast can be. The first thing that is kind of a misconception that I think a lot of people have about becoming a senior developer or moving beyond being a junior is his one, which he has labeled as having all the answer. This expectation that you'll be able to solve all the bugs, know what's wrong in a matter of minutes. And most people that have been in programming for a while, or kind of like anything, as you get older, you realize that there's just so much more. The more that you know, the more that you realize how little that you know. And the exponential rate of the way technology goes, it becomes even more and more true. I don't know if you have much else to say about having all the answers.
Yeah, it is something that I find is, for me, if I'm interviewing someone, it's a signal.
Right? Yeah.
So like, if someone goes, oh no, I don't know how to do that. And that there's a maturity that comes with that answer.
Right.
And it what is often interesting is the more likely someone is to say, I don't know, they're also more likely to be able to say, but here's how I could find out.
Right, right.
And that's, I was gonna say that's that. Also a very sort of senior, you know, I'm not sure, but here's where I would dig. This is how I would sort of, you know, how I would tackle that problem. And yeah, it's definitely a sign of maturity.
I had a chance to co-pilot an interview. I don't know what else to call it. Like basically be the second person there. So there was a manager that was going to hire and they weren't very technical. And this person was theoretically going to be part of my team. And I needed to know these kinds of things. And so again, if they came in and they were acting like they would knew it all right now, that was a problem. But more importantly, what I wanted to know from them was like, okay, so yeah, I don't know that. All right, well, how would you go about finding it out? Like, what would be your techniques? Like, would you ask members of your team? Would you go to the internet? What are your favorite resources? What kinds of things do you read to stay on top of this stuff? Like, are you, it always comes down to one thing. Like, are you interested in learning?
For sure.
You know? Well,
it goes deeper than that too. Obviously, that's important, but I think it also becomes a, so much of programming is a problem solving thing, right? So what you're looking for, the kinds of people I think who end up being better programmers are the ones who can break a problem down and go, okay, well, I'm going to try this. And then if that doesn't work, I'm going to try this. And this is my approach.
Yeah.
And that same mentality is an architecture mentality. It's a, I'm going to, and I don't mean big A massive machines. I just mean that, right. You know, I've got a problem. I got to break it down. I'm going to turn this into seven functions. And you know, these are what the seven functions are going to do, right? That it goes hand in hand with that.
Yeah. And that's way easier for you to think about. Like, again, a follow-up question, like, okay, if you're going to approach this problem, like, tell me how you would tear it apart. Like, what would you approach first? Yeah. What would you tackle first? Like, explain to me, how would you go after this? And I think those are enlightening stuff. And again, a lot of people leave that stuff out in the interview, and that's the problem, is very often the person doing the interview is not the person who's going to have them on their team.
Yeah.
And so that's always kind of interesting to me.
Well, there is an interviewing style as well, which is you just keep going down on something until they say, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
So you start with something and then you ask the question, they give an answer, and then you, like, there's a root cause analysis technique called 5 whys, and it doesn't take very many questions until you're down into almost the quantum physics of it. And in computing, it's sort of the equivalent. It's like, okay, so here's my high level answer. Well, I'd use this thing in the library. I'm okay. Well, that library does this. It doesn't do that. How would we compensate for it? It doesn't take very long before you can get to a place of, okay, now we're into assembly. Okay, I don't know assembly. Okay, good. All right, there. You said what I was listening for. Good.
I'm waiting for the humbleness.
Yes, exactly.
That's funny. So his next talking point is working with the latest tech. Expectation: as senior, you'll be able to play with the latest tech and build amazing projects. And the reality, as he puts it, is the legacy code isn't going anywhere, and neither am I. Let's fix some bugs that happen only once in every full moon. And this comes across a couple different ways. I was a part of a team that the managers of that team were very interested in doing pie in the sky kinds of projects that would get them acclaim across the organization. Mm-hmm. That were shiny and fancy and so forth, but no one at the organization was necessarily interested in them.
Yeah. As sometimes referred to as architecture by resume. The thing that looks best on my resume is the choice of my technology. Yes.
Yeah. And so I found that always kind of interesting, you know, like, again, going back to your answer on the first one, this idea of we're problem solvers, but we're also a form of customer service.
Yeah.
You know, who are your customers here? Who are you building it for? And if you can fix bugs that happen all once in a blue moon, I feel like I'm going to pick on Apple here, but this is the thing that they're constantly chasing, that they feel like all of these things that are out there, we got to have the shiny new set of features every time. And it's like, yeah, but this thing's been broken for a long time. Could you just address this problem that I'm dealing with every day here? And that makes me go, and that's a hard thing.
Yeah. The other aspect of this, which he doesn't touch on under this question in the article, but only working with the latest tech, again, I think one of those signs of maturity is knowing when.
Yeah.
I've seen a few articles in the last 6 months or so that were sort of like, we picked boring and this is the reason we picked boring. Right. And there's a fine line between, you know, picking something that's out of date and then you're the one who's maintaining it and, okay, you know, this isn't changing 5 times every, you know, 5 times a month, and we're having to stay on top of it. And again, one of those signs of maturity is kind of figuring out how to thread that needle. Your goal, back to your point, is to provide something for your customer. And if all you're doing is playing with the neatest little widget, then maybe you're not doing that.
Yeah. This week, I want to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. We discussed earlier in the episode how Python is considered a memory-safe language. Well, this course digs into that concept. It's titled Pointers and Objects in Python, and it's based on a RealPython tutorial by Logan Jones. And video instructor Austin Sapalia takes you through why pointers in Python don't exist. You'll explore the difference between C variables and Python names, how you can simulate pointers in Python, and then how to experiment with real pointers using C types. I think it's a good investment of your time to learn how Python manages objects under the hood. And like most of the video courses on RealPython, the course is broken into easily consumable sections. And where needed, you'll get additional resources and code examples for the techniques shown. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the enhanced search tool on realpython.com. And then this one kind of relates to, I think, your sort of lead-in joke there. He calls it no more boring tasks. As you go from a junior to a senior, you're going to avoid all the boring tasks. And it's like, no, you potentially are going to be in a lot of meetings and be worried about documentation and doing code reviews and training. And maybe that's something you're good at or something you enjoy. But it's interesting for me, I get a chance to, you know, interview a lot of people that have been in the industry for a long time. And I've kind of started asking them questions like, well, how much code are you writing now? And do you miss that? Is that stuff that you miss, or is community organizing the exciting thing for you now, or is managing the thing that's exciting for you? So like, I know that's a balancing act. I don't know what your experience is there.
Well, I find when I've run departments, one of the things that I find I look for in my team leads and my managers are the ones who are willing to take some of the crap jobs.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're interested in growing and developing your team, giving them the interesting work is one of the ways of getting that to happen. And so as the senior guy, sometimes it's a matter of, okay, I'm going to take that on, right? So, you know, it's a minor example, but there have been teams where I've run where I did their timesheets because I was more interested in them spending that time coding than them actually doing the timesheets. And because I knew what they were working on, it's not like we were, you know, doing it in a vacuum, but, you know, right. Here's your five tasks this week. I can go into Jira or whatever and see what it is and put them in the right bucket. And so taking on the boring task sometimes is acting as the feces umbrella for your team. So senior people may end up doing it simply because it's better for your folks and better for their productivity.
I know, I would appreciate that. I don't know. I feel like that's often, you know, a lot of people don't get that. They really want to just remove the umbrella and just redirect the spray.
Yeah. But it's something I learned early on in my career. I did a few co-op terms at IBM, and I got lucky under a manager who was very, very good at hiding the large organization bureaucracy from us.
Nice.
And it was really just a matter of, I'm like, oh, okay, so that's all right. So be like Wilf. All right, got it. Understand. That's a good manager. That's what that looks like.
I guess this is related to that a little bit, in the idea that, oh, I'll be making the big changes now. You know, like I have all these ideas of how I'm going to refactor the entire code base and everything's going to get improved and so forth. And the budget may not be there. The approval may not be there. There's a list of things that are communicated to potentially the senior person that never get down to the junior person, that they, again, that might be reflected in what they get to do. And the assumption is, oh, they're the one steering this ship. And very often there are other set of captains that are involved. So,
well, and it comes back to your point about how much time do they have to code, right? So yeah. Even if, you know, if they're spending half their time doing the managerial bureaucratic stuff, then they have to distribute the big changes, because otherwise the big changes aren't going to happen, right?
Right. Yeah. And then I'll have all this time to relax as I become a senior.
Yeah. I don't understand how anyone could perceive that, but
my work-life balance is going to be amazing. Yeah. A lot of different things shift. It's been an interesting set of years here across the board. And if you were able to accomplish some form of work-life balance, then congratulations to you. But in some ways, I feel like, you know, it's a personal journey for everyone. And right now, I know there's a lot of people that are, you know, struggling. Unfortunately, got laid off in these different times. And so I wonder about those kinds of things. And the assumption is that, oh, it's just going to be a cakewalk after this certain point in my career. And I don't know if that's true.
I suspect some of that comes from the idea that somehow meetings are easy.
Yeah.
And therefore you're relaxing. You can, you know, you can sleep in a meeting. Yeah, sure. Yeah, get away with that for how long? So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the introvert versus extrovert thing for me very often, you know.
Yes, there's that too.
It uses up a lot of cycles. Yep. We're both teachers, and that's a whole other thing, and podcasters, and, you know, that moment that you're on stage and having to really think about like your presentation and what you're doing and this audience, and it's just that amount of energy that's used is pretty different. And so it's a different thing, meeting with management or not. I will get to decide what to do.
Yeah, I love his comment on this one, which is, I miss the times when people told me what to do.
Yeah.
Give me a bug and let me put my head down. That's guidance. Then I don't have to think about it, rather than I have to convince manager that this is the right approach, and get us budget to do it and all the fun stuff that goes along with that.
It's nice to check off boxes, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, there was an organization I worked for that we got into this conversation, product ownership conversation, and I was told that we had to have 37 reports. I'm like, I can only come up with like 5 things we would report on. Why do we need 37 reports? Well, because our competition has 35 reports and we need the little glossy bullet point that says, you know, we have more than them. And so like, you know,
like it's going to be in the marketing materials.
And as managers, you're a little more exposed to how the sausage is made. And right. You know, you're rolling your eyes in front of that only goes so far socially. So yeah, just being told, hey, here's 3 more reports, go do them. Why? No one will use them. It's fine, just go do them. So sometimes there's some value in that. So
yeah. And then becoming irreplaceable. And I think this depends on your personality in some ways, because I've definitely painted myself into that corner many times and felt that way. There have been other times where I've thought of it as a job security, but it isn't, you know, it's not something that you can guarantee. Just because you're the person who knows it or whatever doesn't mean that they won't just throw it all away and give up on it. Or they might be convinced that, oh, newer, smarter, younger people can figure this thing out and so forth. So I think that might be slightly misguided. I don't know what your thoughts are on becoming irreplaceable.
So there's two aspects here. One, doesn't happen as often as you might think. The higher up the food chain you go, the more costly you are to the organization. And so in a downturn, it's often the most expensive person that gets chopped first. So people may not be as irreplaceable as you think they are.
Right.
The other side of it, which is a little more of an optimistic thing, if your goal is to be irreplaceable, what you've just done is you've convinced your organization never to promote you. If you are irreplaceable, then they're not going to move you from where you are onto the next thing because you're irreplaceable. So there's this line between providing value and providing value and leaving yourself in a place where you can grow in your career.
Yeah. And I mean, I look at organizations like different things I've looked at over the years, corporate kind of things. And I feel like the middle managers are never the ones that get cut or laid off. But I mean, it happens. I'm not saying it's always that way, but it seems more often than not that they're going to, you know, remove parts of a person's team and make them work in a leaner way.
Yeah. I guess the one aspect of it is that middle management is often the folks who are responsible for deciding how cutting is going to happen.
Right.
So they're not necessarily going to be the ones who are putting their hands up. That often depends on how massive the structural change is in the organization. And it also it depends on how your organization works as well. There are some out there that are known for being a little more cutthroat, where it's, you know, bottom 10% gets cut every year, sort of bell curvy.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
There's others where it's just we're in a downturn and so we have to readjust or whatever. It's really, really hard to know. And it's... Maybe I'm just really bad at reading the tea leaves when I'm inside of an organization, but I know like there's a guy I've been working with for a few years now, and he keeps putting his hand up for the package because he's like close to retirement. So it keeps being like just package me out. If you package me out, just package me out. And it doesn't happen, right? And in the meantime, there's folks around him that are getting chopped left, right, and center, right? So I think it's far more unpredictable than I think the outside perception of the actual situation is.
Yeah, results may vary.
Exactly. That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So some food for thought there. Let's dig into projects. My project, actually, both of our projects are kind of fun. Actually, you got a couple, I think. Mine is, we've talked about the advent of code multiple times over the last several years. I've had Garana here to talk about it. And there's a subset of people that are interested in, well, could we make a game around data and for data scientists digging into that sort of stuff? And so, hey, I got some more feedback. This one is from AJ, and he wrote, hey there, Christophers. the Real Python podcast crew. I've been digging the recent episodes, digging into some tools for data wrangling. I thought of the show when I saw this announcement about a new data puzzle game on the way. It's called Damaged Goods. The website is whereinthedata.com. And as background, the game he had played, I think, was initially called Hanukkah of Data and is being rolled into the same thing. I think the new name for that puzzle is Noah's Rug. And it's about like a family, has kind of a cool story behind it, not unlike the Advent of Code stuff. He used the original 2022 release to practice with pandas and a tool called Dataset. And then he went in 2023 and reran, converted his workflow into Jupyter and Polars. So he's psyched about having a new data puzzle to dig into and more data wrangling tools to throw at it. He's wondering if data puzzle games would be a generally useful on-ramp for people who want to muck with data tooling beyond a tutorial. But I don't have an obvious practical project in mind. I think this stuff is really cool. And so I appreciate him sharing it. His last note was, whether it is or not, I love the shows. So thanks for rocking. So thanks, AJ, for reaching out. Yeah, I think this is a great approach. I'm interested in this one. It looks, I don't want to say it's a murder mystery, but it looks really interesting. They keep showing this ASCII artwork where you're going to be digging in and learning what's happening. So it sounds like you're much more of a detective. And there are fun ways to kind of dig in and play with this stuff. Thanks again, AJ. And I think it comes out, let me look at the date. The new puzzle is coming sometime in May. And so if you work for a large organization and you want to sponsor this, they're looking for sponsors. And if you want to learn more about it, the site is in the show notes. And thanks again for reaching out, AJ.
Yeah, I just want to comment that one of the Where in the Data programmers, his name's Saul, and he's got a fantastic homepage. It looks like an old school BBS terminal.
Okay.
Which is kind of neat.
Is that the aforementioned Bluebird terminal services?
Not sure. I don't have it up in front of me, but my own homepage has a similar look and feel. And so I'm always, on one hand, you'll have that, oh, I thought my idea was original. And then on the other hand, it's like, oh, there's a soul out there that sees the world the same way I do, with through black and green. But yeah, anyways.
Yeah, that's cool. So what's your projects?
I've got two this week. The first one, like yours, is also a puzzle. So there isn't really much to say about it, which wouldn't spoil it. So I'm just going to kind of describe it and then point folks at it and then move on to my next one. The first one, it's by Oscar Erickson, and it's called The Eval Game. It starts out with a little window where you type in some Python and a rule. And for the first rule I got, I'm not sure if it's the same for everybody or not, but the first rule I got is the expression should evaluate to 42. So I typed in 40 plus 2, and then it says, okay, now here's a new rule. And so it just keeps adding rules, making it harder and harder to build an expression that meets all of that.
Yeah.
So it just kind of keeps going from there. There is a leaderboard link that brings up a Google spreadsheet. So if you want to cheat and see how other people have answered the questions, it's there if you like. Although I suspect by the two leading ones, there used to be some bugs in it because they don't look like they would solve the first answer. But anyhow, so if you like Python and puzzles, this is definitely worth playing around with. So eval game, and of course, we'll link to it.
Yep.
And then the next one is by Roy Resnick, and it's called Rexy. Rexy is a text-based UI for regular expression testing, and it's built using that ever-popular 2E tool, Textual. You either invoke Rexy using a Unix pipe or with a -i option to point it at some content. So let's say you had a file that you wanted to run regexes on, you pass it that file. Once you've got the interface going, it is the screen split into three. The top part is an input for a regex. The bigger middle part is the file that you interacted with. And then the bottom part shows regex groupings. So as you type your regex in the input window, the text from the file gets highlighted and the grouping section gets updated. There's also a nice little drop down to change the regex mode from either find iter to match. And I've played with a couple of online tools like this before, but the big advantage to this one is that it's local. So you're interacting directly with your data on your machine rather than having to paste it into a window or something along those lines. And the other aspect here is regex is there's some variations between programming languages. So you have to always make sure that you're actually looking at the Python variation. And of course, because this is built on Python, you're getting the Python one. Because it's got the find iter and the match, you even know exactly how that's going to behave. So it's very, very clear as to how your expression is and whether or not it's going to work. So all in all, a cool little tool, definitely worth generally installing. So you might want to PyX it or something like that, so it was available anywhere on your system.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks again for bringing all these projects and articles and news this week, Christopher.
Always fun.
All right. Talk to you soon. And don't forget, installing Sentry is easy. New users get 3 full months of the team plan when you use the code REALPYTHON on signup. I want to thank Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.